Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio is on the air. From Los Angeles, I'm Royal Oaks of ABC News and the law firm of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, inviting you to join us for Hinshaw Law Radio. This program features prominent lawyers and insurance industry professionals discussing insurance and reinsurance cases, issues, and developments. Before we get started, a reminder that the information on Insurance Law Radio is provided for general information purposes only. Nothing stated in the program constitutes legal advice or creates any attorney-client relationship. You should consult directly with an attorney of your choosing if you wish to obtain any advice with respect to any claim or matter. Any views expressed are those of the guests and are not necessarily the views of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, or any of its clients. And now we go to Chicago and your host for Insurance Law Radio, the co-chair of Hinshaw & Culbertson's National Insurance Services Practice Group, Scott Seaman.
Thank you, Royal Oaks, and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Hinshaw's Insurance Law Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. A quick reminder that you can listen to this episode or prior episodes on demand by going to Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio at blogtalkradio.com, or you can visit hinshawlaw.com, go to the insurance and reinsurance page, and click on multimedia. On this episode of Insurance Law Radio, we will be discussing the Illinois Department of Insurance, the face of contemporary regulation, activity, and initiatives. Our special guest is Ms. Jennifer Hammer, the director of the Illinois Department of Insurance. And we could not have a better guest to discuss this topic. Jennifer was appointed by Illinois Governor Bruce Rauner to serve as a director of the Illinois Department of Insurance in early 2017. And it did not take her long to get confirmed as a director in February of 2017. And she has the distinction of being the first woman to serve as a confirmed director of insurance in Illinois. This past January, Jennifer also became the chair of the Property and Casualty Insurance Committee of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and that's a very important position. I should begin by providing a little background on Jennifer, because if I provide too much, it could take the entire time of the show. She is highly credentialed. She's had more than a decade of experience in healthcare law and policy. She previously served as deputy chief of staff for policy in the office of the governor, where she worked closely with the state agencies to develop and implement the governor's public policy agenda. And she's also served as special counsel to the governor and in a variety of other positions. And prior to joining state government, Jennifer was the associate vice president legal counsel for the government affairs group for the Illinois Chamber of Commerce. And she's been a lawyer before that in private practice, focusing on insurance defense, healthcare, business litigation, and advising clients on legislation, including the Affordable Care Act. So, Jennifer, you come to us highly credentialed, and we are so pleased to have you here on Hinshaw's Insurance Law Radio.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So you wear two very important hats now. First, as the director of insurance, and secondly, as the chair of the National Association of Insurance Commissioners Property and Casualty Insurance Committee. But there's quite a bit of overlap, really, between the two functions, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. So in both the functions, we are interacting with the stakeholders, whether it's industry or consumers, and making sure that we take a balanced approach at helping consumers get the services or things that they contracted for, and helping industry have speed to market or getting products out there or being innovative, and really handholding both sets of customers. I think a lot of times we lose sight of who's the customer when we're in a state agency. And so since my arrival back in 2017, I've talked ad nauseum with the employees there about who the customer is. And it truly is not only the companies who are filing products with us, and maybe their financial statements, annual statements, or pilots that they would like to get to market, but also the consumer. And I think the NAIC takes that approach and helps the 56 member states, so the territories and the states are members of the NAIC, and takes that approach across the board and really provides an opportunity for us as either the director or commissioner in the respective states to network with each other and really get to the best resolution or balancing, if you will.
Well, and on our next episode, we'll focus on the NAIC, but on this episode, and because you have so much to say and that our listeners need to hear, we're going to do back-to-back episodes. This time, we're going to focus on the Illinois Department of Insurance and the work and the leadership you bring there. And probably the best place to start is a little bit of an overview of the role and the responsibilities of the department.
Sure. I think that's a great place to start. And I mentioned a little bit about the balancing. And when I arrived, we had a mission statement, and the mission statement was to protect consumers by providing assistance and information, by efficiently regulating the insurance industry's market behavior and financial solvency, and by fostering a competitive insurance marketplace. But as I did some research on management and how to really get buy-in from the employees to want to serve those customers we just talked about, the insurance companies and the consumers, it became evident that they really needed a vision statement as well, an action statement that helped would guide our action items later in our planning. And so we had a couple offsite meetings where the senior team really put together some options for a vision statement. And then we circulated that vision statement in several different forms. So some options for the entire employee base, and had the employees at the department vote on the vision statement so that truly the employees felt like they were selecting the path for the department. And then we felt like we had guardrails to either say yes or no to action items or initiatives as we traverse the next couple of years while I would be there. And so what we developed was embracing efficiency and innovation, which we'll probably talk about some of that today, to educate and protect Illinois insurance consumers and to encourage a vital and robust Illinois insurance marketplace. And so as we talk about the department, I think my whole goal when I arrived was to leave the department and really the state of insurance here in the state of Illinois in a better place than when I arrived. And using those guardrails, we've made some really great strides, but we're still working day to day to try to implement some of those action items. I've also really tried to encourage this staff to have pride and respect. And then I think overall, we lose sight sometimes of the fact that we are truly stewards of the public dollar, right? So the taxpayers pay our salaries, every employee there. And so trying to remind them to be efficient and good stewards of the taxpayers of the state of Illinois.
Well, I tell you, it's awfully refreshing to hear how you describe the vision and how you went about coming up with an action plan and the recognition of the need to serve both consumers and companies as well as taxpayers. It's a lot of constituencies. You have a lot of priorities between regulatory on introducing products, regulating products, regulating market conduct, and so forth. It's a lot for anybody to have on their plate, but I think the fact that you started out by setting this vision and priorities really makes it easy for your staff to follow through.
I completely agree. And for me, it really was, you don't think about it at the time, but it was a helpful mechanism to say no to things that maybe didn't fit within the priorities of the governor or of my time at the department. And a lot of times you want to do everything, but you need to limit what you actually are going to be able to accomplish. And in year one, we accomplished 11 of the 12 initiatives we set out to accomplish. One was simply a matter of reallocation of resources and deciding once we got into that initiative that we weren't going to do it. And so really having the backbone to say no to things has allowed us to accomplish a lot more than if we were triaging and multitasking and trying to do a lot of different things. And so thank you for the recognition of that. And that process was a difficult process. It took a very long time. It took longer than you would anticipate to put together something like that.
I was going to say, you know, you take the position over, you have an idea, and now you're into it for a couple of years. What are the couple takeaways that you have in terms of things being a little bit different maybe than what you envisioned?
Sure. I think we have the same difficulties that you could imagine with hiring and attrition and some of the things that happen in the private sector. You know, a lot of our employees are traversing between different departments, which makes it more difficult to have a consistent staff that's knowledgeable and can address issues on a timely basis. I also have had the pleasure, if you will, of having a lot of uncertainty out of Washington for a period of time, which has truly taken a lot of time to prepare. So every time we have an announcement like we had very recently about association health plans, I have developed really several different approaches in anticipation of what it might be. So when it comes out and it looks like exactly one of those items that you thought it might look like, that feels good, right? Because you're prepared and you know how you're going to react to that. But the continued uncertainty takes an extreme amount of staff time to prepare for some of those things. I think the key takeaways have been truly that there are really good employees at that department that I have enjoyed working with immensely. And as long as you give them kind of the freedom and opportunity to do great things, they will. And I think we ran an initiative last year called Shark Tank that allowed employees to come present ideas just like they would on the show about efficiencies and ways to improve the department. And so I think that empowered the employees to really think of ideas that maybe they felt like they couldn't otherwise do. Some of those ideas were very complex. Some of them had problems, but not solutions, but really allowing me to sit there for a couple days and listen to the issues that these employees have had for a couple decades and haven't had maybe someone to listen to them or felt like their opinion was going to be heard, and then taking action items based on those. And they can be very small things. Some of the one of the things we just started this month was the Employees Club. The ability for them to raise money and have a holiday party was something that they just couldn't even imagine they could do again, right? And for me, I'm going, of course, let me buy some of the stuff, right? And let's have a holiday party and let's really celebrate the hard work you've done all year long. And so I think that the key takeaway for me is there are really good employees. They need empowered to do the right thing and guided by a leader that will tell them no on certain things, but yes, in an effort to get to, you know, a mutual ending point or conclusion or something that's going to benefit both the consumers and the companies here in Illinois.
Yeah, to be able to walk the proper balance between achieving the department's and the governor's goals on one hand, but not falling into this bureaucratic sort of state of mind where nothing really happens. You know, things take place, charges are incurred, but the results aren't there. So, you know, using your human resources the way you have is a tremendous benefit for the people of the state of Illinois. Let's talk for a few minutes about some of the issues and some of the areas that as the head of the department you're watching and that you're following.
Sure. So there's been a multi-agency working group that's been watching autonomous vehicles. We know those are coming. We don't know when. There's obviously level fours already on the road and just kind of watching what's happening with autonomous vehicles, making sure that the consumers are protected and the level of protection that consumers desire or need is at least available to them, and they have the ability to shop around and get something that works for them when that occurs. I think we all know we're watching some of these cases that have occurred. There's an Arizona case where injuries occurs, and I think we're waiting for the courts to make a decision on what type of insurance is necessary with some of these, but preparing nonetheless in the interim. So really watching autonomous vehicles as it develops quickly, trying to figure out where that's going. I think we, you know, we have quite a bit of staff resources dedicated to that on the property and casualty side. And then we're also watching the Illinois Omnibus Bill passed. That is a term that I've called this bill. It maybe doesn't even make it outside the department called that, but a large bill, 1737, Senate Bill 1737 passed both the House and the Senate in this legislative session, and has a myriad of different components with different stakeholders, at least five different major components of the bill. And so trying to make sure we do an analysis of that bill and make a recommendation to the governor. It's under review. I don't know what the governor will do at this point in time, but you know, it contains everything from some limitations on short-term limited duration plans to credit for reinsurance, a component that the department needs for accreditation, and that bill has been filed for a very long time, multiple years. It has a division bill in there, which allows companies to allocate different blocks of business in ways maybe they couldn't in the past. It's utilized in Connecticut, and actually Oklahoma just passed that bill. It also has some work comp rate review in there, and the stakeholders on all of these look a little bit different. There's a captive insurance premium tax reduction, and so there is a lot of stakeholders in a very complex bill that is highly technical, and so really trying to finish our analysis of that bill and make some recommendations to the governor and see how that will go. I anticipate, you know, the bill is not on his desk yet, so the legislature needs to pass the bill to him, and then he'll have 60 days to review that bill. So watching what I'm deeming the Illinois omnibus bill very closely, a lot of components of that are of interest to different stakeholders.
So you're getting ready really to make recommendations to the governor, and then the next step being, if it does get signed into law, implementing the portions of it you would have responsibility to implement.
That's right. And so we are up for accreditation in September from the NAIC. And one of the things that we need is this credit for reinsurance model law. Short-term limited duration, not much implementation there. It's changing the time period essentially from 12 months to 6 months. Some of the other things, the premium tax implication is something that would be a rollback from a 2014 bill. The division bill would be new. So we've been aware that the division bill has been out there and have been, you know, preparing to implement that. I would say the most complex or difficult portion to implement is going to be the work comp rate review portion if it gets passed. So if the bill is signed into law, you know, we will have to figure out how to do that portion of the bill. As you know now, that isn't the type of state we are in. So we don't have the staff necessary to do something like that. But remembering that the governor has multiple options, he can mandatorily veto the bill. He can do a full veto if he would like, and or he could sign it into law. And so I would say in the next 90 days or so, we'll see some progress on that bill, whatever it might be. And then if there is a veto, you know, they have veto session in November for a couple weeks in Springfield. And so if it is vetoed, we'll be watching very carefully to see what the House and the Senate do down there.
Oh, one of the other things you are watching is what you call, I think, mental health parity. And our astute listeners already know that that's just impossible, that you have superior mental health to the host. So what is all of that about?
Sure. So mental health parity, a couple of years ago, the legislature passed House Bill 1, which was a strengthening of mental health parity here in Illinois. I think Illinois stakeholders would argue it's the strongest in the nation. There also is a federal requirements for mental health parity. And so the department's charged with implementing, regulating mental health parity. What that means is that the services provided to a mental health patient are on par with are in parity with med-surg, which is medical surgical, which is your traditional health ailments that you would encounter, a hip surgery, a knee surgery.
So it's on parity with physical health issues.
That's right. So your physical health issues may have, you know, your primary may have a $20 copay and a specialist may have a $40 copay. So we're looking at not only the quantitative portions like that to make sure that your primary mental health physician would have a $20 copay and a specialist would have a $40, but the more complex portion is the non-quantitative limit. So looking at some of those things. And so we take it very seriously, and we take a four-pronged approach of mental health parity, and we start with compliance. So as you know, insurance companies file products with us all the time. In fact, we just got a wave of health products filed with us as a result of the on-exchange plans being due at the end of last month. And so when they file a product with us, we're going through the product filing and looking through and making sure that all of the state and federal mandates are in that product. And so last year, You know, we got some of these products that maybe had some questions about these products and would make objections based on whether or not these products had what we thought was the right amount of coverage. But we are implementing an automated tool. So right now, a human looks at every line of those products as they're filed. And I said, well, how, you know, we're going to, humans naturally may have different approaches when they're reading the same language, same plain meaning of the language. And so we procured, we went out to RFP, request for proposal, and procured a company to take an automated approach or an automated tool to the initial review of those. So we call that the compliance portion. So our compliance division looks at the product filings that come in. The second prong is what I think most people think about when they're thinking about whether we're regulating appropriately. It's the complaint division of the department, and what they look at is an individual consumer can call and say, hey, this is happening to me. I think I should have coverage, and my company is not, my insurance company is not covering it the way I thought it should be covered, or the way they told me it was going to be covered, or the way you've told me it should be covered, right? And so we handle those on a one-by-one basis. You know, we have all the insurance information about that specific consumer and talk to the insurance company, and then almost act as a mediator between the two and make sure we get the resolution that the consumer contracted for, right? So they're in a contractual relationship and making sure that they are getting what they paid for.
But without rewriting the agreement.
That's exactly right. So it's whatever they agreed to. So originally we're looking at these agreements, right, and making sure they meet our requirements, and then the company sell them. And then it is truly about half the time we side with the insurance company and half the time we side with the consumer. And a lot of times it's just informing the consumer that this actually wasn't covered. This isn't a part of mental health parity, but also using those complaints to see if we see trends which would trigger our market conduct examination.
Mm-hmm.
So the third prong would be our market conduct examinations. We're doing targeted examinations on quite a few health companies right now. Probably the first in the nation to take this approach. And in fact, just gave a speech about this to some additional general counsels last week, as you know. And so in our market conduct examinations, are just making sure we're looking at the quantitative and non-quantitative treatment limitations and making sure mental health parity is being addressed like it should. And so
you went on some major statewide tour.
Yes. So our fourth prong is consumer education. And so we protect and educate consumers, and we sent staff members to all 102 counties, called every legislator in the state, and took with us mental health toolkits and met with consumers that had questions and made sure they had the resources necessary to understand their plan. Sometimes they don't even understand the words mental health parity, right? I think the most important thing to know in the mental health parity world is...
By the way, I sort of illustrated that earlier.
Yes. Yeah, that's all right. I think the most important thing to note here is that a lot of times we think it's just the consumer that can come to us and get help, or that we only interact with companies. And so we've tried to get out there and tell people that the provider actually has the ability to file a complaint on behalf of the consumer as long as they get the right paperwork in place. And so if a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a physician of any type that is dealing with a mental health patient needs our assistance, if they just get approval from the consumer, we can help the providers as well, which is a path that I don't think people traditionally think about with the Department of Insurance.
Yeah, exactly. And so not only mental health, but what are some of the other health issues you're keeping your eye on? I would imagine with the Affordable Care Act or the Unaffordable Care Act exchanges and the state of the market and the state of changing regulations emanating from Washington has a tremendous impact.
Right. So we right now are doing a couple things. We have the plans filed. We're looking at rates to see what the rates look like, make sure all the counties are covered, doing an actuarial analysis, and then we'll turn them over. Actually, today, some of the information will get turned over to HIOS, and the feds will have some of the information that they need. But as you know, we work through the summer to determine rates. We don't release rates early. That's always a question about what do the rates look like on initial filing. But those rates change almost every single time. And so we don't like to confuse consumers. So we just release them one time so that they know what the actual final rates are, and have done that since the inception of the ACA. And I would say the second thing we're watching, but we're not just standing by and watching. We're actively working on, and we think we're probably the first state in the nation to do this, a revision to our benchmark plan. And so there was talk for a period of time that there was going to be the allowance of the revision to the benchmark plan. The benchmark plan is the baseline for what has to be covered if you would like to sell on the exchange. So you're looking at all of your state and federal mandates, making sure that plan has that coverage in there, and then saying, okay, all your other plans, you have to look at this plan. This is your baseline plan. And so we felt like this was a perfect opportunity to continue our advocacy for mental health parity. And we haven't talked yet about opioid abuse, but definitely near and dear to me. And I know the governor and some of our other sister agencies. And so we are revising the benchmark plan. It is due very early next month. And we have a partnership with a local school of medicine to help us revise that benchmark plan based on making improvements for solving the opioid crisis and making sure there's mental health parity in the benchmark plan as well.
And I was going to say a lot of expertise goes into that because, you know, you are fundamentally an insurance public policy person, but, you know, we have to deal with, you know, what sort of plan do you want to be the benchmark so that it provides a sufficient baseline of coverage, but yet doesn't provide coverage that may be more than optimal considering the cost, because no coverage is worse than a plan that provides a lesser extent of coverage. How do you, and so I think you gave part of the answer, is it, but how do you go about figuring, making that right mix?
Right. So I think we considered all of those exact things, factors when deciding how to change a benchmark plan. And I think what we'll eventually propose, that we're not there yet, but is 5 to 7 changes based solely on this opioid mental health parity issue itself, or behavioral health, if you will, that it's talked about in combination sometimes. And we did that intentionally so that we weren't really confusing consumers. As soon as you start stripping away the benefits, it would be a monumental task to educate consumers about what is, what isn't in there. And truly, we're trying to just move the needle on a crisis that's happening across the entire nation. And so we focused on that rather than deciding whether to increase other benefits or decrease benefits. And you're right, paying for services that maybe that specific consumer doesn't mean just increased cost, the possibility that it's unaffordable for that consumer and then they go without coverage, especially with the elimination of the individual mandate penalty. And so we decided to really focus on mental health parity and opioid abuse. And that's how we got away from it.
But you can't open a newspaper or turn on the TV and watch the news without hearing about opioids. It's a tremendous, as you point out, national crisis. And we know in the federal omnibus spending bill, a lot of money allocated to opioid abuse and treatment and prevention. How much of that has made its way to Illinois, and any of that to your department?
So we are very hopeful that we will hear in the next week or so on a federal grant that we've applied for applicable to the opioid crisis. And we don't know the dollar amount yet, hoping obviously over 100,000 at least, you know, so we can have some staff resources and the ability to address the crisis. But no, we haven't been able to get an answer from CMS yet. I think we're hopeful that it's coming in a very short time period here. So
yeah, it would help a lot of people. Well, one of the things that's a recent development earlier this month was the decision in the Land of Lincoln case. And I was hoping you could educate our listeners a little bit about what that case is all about and what the rulings were.
Sure, happy to do that. So the Land of Lincoln case is a case about the risk corridor payments, which were an obligation of the federal government to insurance companies based on, for lack of a more complex term, based on their losses. And so there is, from a legal perspective, debate between whether there's an obligation based on some plain language compared to a lack of appropriation. And so the feds did not appropriate the risk corridor payments for a period of years. I am involved in the case because I'm actually the receiver for Land of Lincoln. So Land of Lincoln was a cooperative that was started here in Illinois because of the lack of risk corridor payments. It shut down a year or so ago, a little more than that actually, and about 50,000 Illinoisans lost their coverage at that time and had to find new coverage. And so when something like that happens, there are traditionally protections in place for the consumer, but they go over to an office called the Office of Special Deputy Receiver, and I'm the receiver of note on file in that case. And I'm obviously vigorously defending Land of Lincoln, acting as if I, you know, am running that company. That's a statutory duty of mine. And so we lost at the appellate court in D.C. That case just last week. And as the ruling came back down, I think we anticipated, just as we have done in other scenarios, that we may lose. And if we lose, what are we going to do? And we feel confident in saying that we are going to file for rehearing. We're going to ask for the court to sit en banc, which means the entire court would sit and we would have the ability to discuss with them or argue orally our case again. And so we have 45 days from last week to file that. So I anticipate that'll be coming in, you know, a month or so.
Well, I have to say that the Office of Special Deputy Receiver is probably the branch of your department I've had the most contact with over the years, very professional group. And one of the areas that, frankly, regulators don't get enough credit for is financial solvency of insurance companies. You know, when I first started practicing in the late 80s, that was a major issue. Insurers going insolvent, whether it was asbestos or long tail or other claims. And that's one area that I think in Illinois and across the country, regulators have done a great job in assuring the financial viability of insurance companies.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to our balancing that we talked about at the very beginning of this, making sure you protect the consumers, but are also handholding industry, because it just benefits the consumers when you are helping them. And so having a good communication between the Department of Insurance and Office of Special Deputy to make sure that when you are seeing a company's risk-based capital decreasing at alarming levels, you're having a discussion about why. You know, are there claims? Is something major happening? Did they have a major catastrophe that may cause this and they're going to bounce back and everything's going to be fine? Do they have some internal struggles? Maybe their corporate structure and looking at whether they need to put more capital in, those types of things. And so making sure there's a communication stream between the office that you mentioned and the department is imperative. And so that's one of the things that I've really stressed between them, right? You want to make sure that you are encouraging the companies to get out of a troubled situation, but in the event they can't, you need to make sure we're protecting the consumers and communicating with the guarantee funds and making sure that everyone knows the risk that is sitting out there.
So other than your three children and your husband, what is it that keeps you up at night?
So I would say, for me, making sure the consumer really knows the product they purchased. And I think we've been really successful at increasing speed to market with industry, but the consumers, as we progress, insurance is not going to get more, you know, simpler, right? The product is going to be more difficult. And you want there to be choice on the market, but you also want the consumer to be informed. And where is that balance? So you want a renter to be able to purchase insurance maybe that is very narrowly tailored to what their life is like. So they're not paying for something that they would never have. An internal, you know, apartment may never see wind or hail damage, right? Like, but they're paying for that because it's not allowed to be flexible at this time. You're not allowed to, you know, deviate from the standard fire policy maybe. And so making sure that you're trying to figure out that perfect balance between innovation and then an informed consumer, knowing what they purchase and then helping them get what they purchase.
Yeah, and more difficult because, as you say, with cyber liabilities and cyber insurance products, just one example, companies are coming out with that. They're changing forms frequently to try and address market demands. And also, you don't have the long history of court decisions on coverage issues. So it's very, the pace of things is extraordinary.
Yeah, and you mentioned cyber, and I should mention that I think what keeps maybe the guarantee funds up at night is cyber, right? So we don't know, as we talked about, the courts still are determining autonomous vehicle cases. The courts are also still determining what is actually a damage in a cyber case, right? Does the damage occur when the information is stolen, or does the damage occur when the information was stolen and then used? Is there a second step when the damage occurs? And so trying to figure out what that risk actually looks like, compounding the fact of the inability to determine where the damage occurs, you have the unknown risk of language that may be interpreted to cover cyber in very old grandfathered policies, right? So some of these legacy companies that have grandfathered policies that are very old, they may be covering cyber without actually rating for it. They don't realize the ambiguity.
Null risk property policy or general liability policy.
That's right. That's right.
So I want to get the benefit of a few recommendations and thoughts from you for a couple elements of our listenership. One would be for insurance agents and brokers.
Sure. So agents and brokers, I think, are going to continue to be relevant. I think the question I most frequently get from them is, what should we be doing, right? And I try to explain that they should be thinking about themselves as a liaison and educator for the product, not just an agent that helps them get the product in the traditional way that they have gotten the product to the consumer previously. Technology is moving very quickly, but we talked about the complexity of the product is not diminishing, right? So you are still going to need someone to help you get the right product for you, and how they do that is something that they should consider.
So initially, the way I phrased this next question was to begin by saying, you know, there's always tensions between regulatory bodies and the companies that they regulate. But what I found very interesting and insightful was your approach of including companies as well as consumers as constituents. But from a perspective of an insurance company dealing with a regulatory body, you know, there are ways to work cooperatively. And I was just wondering some of your thoughts on a couple of things that you think are constructive approaches taken by insurance companies, and maybe a couple that aren't so constructive.
Sure. So I actually put in a formal process just this year. We hired a deputy director over the Division of Innovation. So we established a division, hired a deputy, moved some market analysis people under there, but really did it so the insurance companies have an entry point. So they may sell different products or have rating over in our financial corporate division, but their consumers are being handled over in health products, or, you know, they may traverse the entire agency and deal with, you know, a dozen different people. And I wanted to provide them a single entry point, especially for innovative products. And so my suggestion to them is to utilize that deputy as frequently as they would like. And the deputy will tell them how the department would like the process to flow. And so instead of just filing a product and then fighting about what the product is that you filed and whether there actually does need to be some objections or some amendments or whatever it may be, come to us and let's chat. And let's talk about what you want to file. Let's work together and partner to get the consumers a great product at a less cost, right? And so that's happening through our Division of Innovation in a formal process. And so in order to keep the playing field equal, we'll amend the checklist. We have checklists that companies watch and are supposed to abide by before they file a product. So we'll amend our checklist and then send that out in our SIR system, our software system, to notify other companies, hey, there's been a change to the checklist. Everyone can file something based on this change to the checklist. And then that company that came to our Division of Innovation can later file something. So really trying to keep the playing field equal for them.
Well, that's terrific, Jennifer. And I have to tell you, it's been a remarkable first couple of years. I think a lot of achievements in the Illinois Department of Insurance. And we thank you very much for joining us on Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, our guest for this episode has been Jennifer Hammer, the director of the Illinois Department of Insurance. And as always, we welcome your suggestions about future topics and guests you'd like to hear and issues you'd like to hear discussed on future episodes. I'm Scott Seaman, thanking you for joining us on Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio. We look forward to speaking with you soon on other topics of interest to insurers and insurance professionals and decision makers. Thank you.
You've been listening to Hinshaw & Culbertson LLP's Insurance Law Radio. The information contained in this program is provided solely for general informational purposes and does not constitute legal advice. For information on past and upcoming Insurance Law Radio programs, visit the Insurance Services Practice Group page of www.hinshawlaw.com. This is Royal Oaks thanking you for joining us and inviting you to join us for the next episode of Insurance Law Radio.